Hey, it's Bree Bagwell from Only Vans, and 2024 is coming to a close, and we wanted to remind you what's happened this year on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. Tom Power spoke to the great Allison Krauss on season 2 of Toy Heart, a podcast about bluegrass.
Can you define what you're looking for when you find a song? Is there anything more than a gut feeling?
It like instantaneously brings pictures. Instantly, it's a movie.
Portland songwriters Anna Tivel and Jeffrey Martin drop by Basic Folk.
I like the way you talk.
I like the way you talk.
Hey, thanks. It's funny to me that you're in the backyard right now and I'm in the house.
And finally, on my podcast, Only Vans, we welcomed another beloved musical couple, Cody and Shannon Canada.
I wasn't a metalhead. I mean, I listened to a little bit, but I had to like sneak it because my mom thought I was going to worship Satan and drink goat blood or some shit.
Parents still think that, by the way.
Thanks for a great year. And listen to all these and more on the BGS Podcast Network or wherever you get your shows.
Hey, it's Cindy and Lizzie. We're here with some exciting updates. First, we'll tell you why your support means so much to Basic Folk. Then we'll spill the beans about our brand new logo launching this January. Before we get into that, our fundraiser is almost over. We're so close to hitting our goal. Lizzie, tell them more.
Thank you, Cindy. We have been blown away by the amazing support so far. Shout out to Neil from Connecticut, Fip from Nebraska, and Jeffrey from Washington State. Your generosity is incredible. Thanks to you, we're just 3 donations away from reaching our goal. 3 donations! Be one of the 3 people today that we need by making a donation at basicfolk.com.
So why should you support Basic Folk? Because we're all about creating thought-provoking, honest conversations with folk musicians. This show celebrates under-the-radar roots artists, giving them a platform to share their stories, struggles, and inspirations. There's no other space like this, and your support makes it all possible.
Oh my God, exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself, Cindy. All of these contributions cover essential costs like website fees, support staff, and production. We are rich in heart, but we rely on your generosity to keep this mission alive. Right now, we just need 3 more monthly donors to cross that finish line. Are you going to be one of them? Da, 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 da.
Wow, inspo. They say 3 is a magic number.
It is. It's a waltz.
It's also a very fun number. And here's another fun thing. New monthly donors will be the first to get the Basic Folk beanie with our fresh logo, which is launching in January. And these aren't just any beanies. You know, you can walk into L.L. Bean or...
Oh, come on, L.L. Bean.
You can walk into Patagonia and get a beanie. You can't get these beanies in L.L. Bean. These beanies are handmade by my mom and are little works of art. And they're so cute.
These beanies are the cutest little beanie babies, and you're going to want to collect them all.
Ding.
They are the perfect way to show your love for Basic Folk and keep your head warm. Just head to basicfolk.com/donate and sign up as a monthly donor today. It's super easy. For just $5 a month, you will support this show and snag that cozy beanie, and we will not need to ask you for money in the same way the next time around.
Also, strategically, we have placed this monthly donation, $5 a month, to get the Basic Folk beanie. That was how much a beanie baby cost in 1994. $5.
Are we doing like economic archival activism over here?
That's correct. So for the price of 1 beanie baby at the store in 1994 per month, you can get a Basic Folk beanie. And thank you so much for supporting Basic Folk. Let's hit that goal together and keep celebrating the musicians and stories we all love. Donate today at basicfolk.com/donate or the link in the show notes. Bye.
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 Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians
on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm your host, Cindy House. Lizzie Noh is here with me today, ladies and gentlemen. Please give her a hand.
Guys, it's Americana Week. Let's talk about it. Everyone and their mother, all of my friends, frenemies, rivals, ex-lovers, everyone's in Nashville. And it's a real time. I'm stoked about it.
Not me. I'm in Maine going on bird walks. Thank you very much. On the podcast today, Lisa Loeb is here. Holy shit.
Lisa freaking Loeb is on the podcast. I got to talk to her. What a legend.
Did she say that you only hear what you want to?
No, but I did that
any way of my own accord. I always only hear what I want to.
If you'd like to sign up for Basic Folk's newsletter, I'll tell you what, my friend, that is the best way for you to stay in touch with Basic Folk, and you can do so at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com, sign up there. It's a once-a-month email in your inbox, and it lets you know what's going on with your favorite folk podcast. You can also follow us on social media, at Basic Folk Pod. We are on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. You can also make a financial contribution because that really helps us out a lot. And it allows Lizzie and I to not go bankrupt trying to bring you this cute little adorable fun time podcast that we do.
Which is also a very serious and intellectual podcast of historic importance, I might say.
Brains and beauty.
Women. That's the power of women. It's cute and it's important.
You can make a contribution at basicfolk.com or you can follow the link in the show notes. Lizzie.
Cindy.
Is there anything aside from Americana Fest that you want to talk about today?
I'm about to go on my first European tour in a couple of, in a few weeks. And it is all I think about. I'm going to be on the bus with Sam Beam and his wonderful band and crew. And I can't wait to like come back to Basic Folk and report back everything that I learn about places like Germany and the Netherlands.
Your accent is going to be so weird when you come back. How many languages are you learning to prepare?
I'm learning all of the languages. I've canceled all of my commitments for the next month so I can just be full-time on Duolingo. And I'm going to treat it like a semester abroad. I'm going to come back and I'm going to be eating fancy cheese and I'm going to be better than you.
I'm so happy for you. If you want to follow along, or if you are in Europe, go see Lizzie open for Sam Beam of Iron and Wine.
The Iron and Wine tour is going to be a highlight of my life, and I hope that I see some of our Basic Folk besties out there.
Excellent. You know, do the secret handshake when you meet Lizzie, which is don't touch each other.
Don't touch me if you see me in public. I might love you, but I'm not comfortable with that.
Great. Anything else?
No, do you have anything else to share?
No.
One thing that I would love to plug is that I am on a panel this week at Americana Fest hosted by Ann Powers about her new book, Traveling, which is a book about Joni Mitchell. And I am loving the book. I really think that our listeners should get it. It's not a traditional biography. It's like music criticism about transitional moments in Joni Mitchell's life and career. I am finding it super fascinating, and I love Anne's approach to her subject. She didn't interview Joni in person, and that's like discussed at the beginning of the book. She really wanted to remain objective and a little bit removed from Joni Mitchell the person and really be able to dive into Joni Mitchell the artist and historical figure. So it's a really interesting ride. People, go get this book. Traveling.
Excellent. Today, another legend of our time, Lisa Loeb, is on Basic Folk.
Okay, I got to talk with Lisa Loeb, and I just want to say that as just like a bragging thing, not even to do with the podcast. Like, I, Lizzie Noh, got to talk with Lisa Loeb. When I think about everything that she has accomplished so far, she has had a wildly successful and really unique and adventurous career. Looking back on it so far, it feels like inevitable that Lisa Loeb was going to be a musician. But as a kid, she was interested in all different types of things. You know, she was into music. She was also into theater. She got her degree in comparative literature. And it was actually her sort of theater and film side hustles that got her her first big break. Lisa has the honor of being the first artist to have a number one single on the Billboard charts without having signed a recording contract. And she was so generous with her story. Like, one of the things that I think is so important in music, especially folk music, is transparency. And I got to talk with Lisa about this like pivotal moment in her career and what made it possible for her to achieve this commercial success without doing the rite of passage that we assume goes with that, signing a recording contract. The plot twist that I find most interesting about Lisa Loeb's career is that the second half of her career has been devoted to creating children's music. And it's a gift that keeps on giving in her life because Lisa has
kept herself playful and curious and open-hearted in a way that I think a lot of adults might find unfamiliar and a little kooky, and I find super inspiring. We talked about family, we talked about career, we talked about songwriting, we talked about what it takes to make an engaging children's album that people of all ages can enjoy. And this new album, That's What It's All About, takes one big swing that I was kind of like terrified by. She covered one of the most famous songs of all time, The Hokey Pokey. And so I was like, Lisa Loeb, what does it take to cover one of the most recognizable songs of all time and make it your own? But of course she succeeds because she's so creative and she has this distinct sound that fans have come to love over the decades. You're going to love That's What It's All About, especially the original song, Take It While the Taking's Good. I think that's my favorite song from the record. And I hope people can listen to a clip of it.
That's right. We're going to listen to a clip of it right meow. And then we'll get to our conversation
with Lisa Loeb
on Basic Folk.
You stop at a stand for a cold lemonade, 'cause the sun's beating down. So go find the shade. It's getting hotter. Don't teeter totter. Better finish before your ice turns to water. Hey, buddy, take life by the reins. Play with the bubbles before they go down the drain. Make a decision, it's not long division. Take it while the taking's good, oh yeah. Take it while the taking's good. You waited in line for your favorite treat. So take a bite, don't stare at your feet. If you don't think quick, step out on the floor. Take it while the taking's good. Oh yeah. Take it while the taking's good.
Lisa Loeb, welcome to Basic Folk. I am so happy to have you here. I want to dig in so quickly because there's truly so many highlights of your career that I want to talk about, as well as your new incredible children's album, That's What It's All About. So for starters, how did your parents introduce music into your life? Were there types of music that you kind of all agreed on before you started to develop your own taste in music?
Oh my gosh, there was music before I even knew that there wasn't music. There was always music. Some of my earliest memories of music are going with my mom to her dance classes. Before she was really a full-time mom, she was still taking a few dance classes when I think it was just my older brother and my little sister and I. It might have even been just my older brother and I. But I remember being in dance class, hearing music like It's a Beautiful Day. And I loved hearing music in that context. I would sit in the corner. Later I was a dancer also, but that, yes. I loved hearing music there. There was always, you know, the radio kind of like in the car, those old school just radios. And I listened to what was popular, everything from songs like Windy. Everyone knows it's Windy. Led Zeppelin and just the songs that were on the radio when I was really little. And then at home, my parents had a big record collection, or what seemed like a big record collection. They had a lot of the popular things of the day, like musicals, which were really popular. And my mom loved musicals, like I feel like Oklahoma and some of the classic musicals. And then as we went along, I mean, my parents just always let us listen to music, get records, things like that. And my siblings and I were really into everything from Queen to Kiss to Olivia Newton-John, soft pop from the 70s. And it went from there. Also, My dad would play a lot of piano. He's a doctor, but he enjoyed playing piano, and he would sit and play through his fake books. There were certain songs he played more than others, but there were a lot of songs from the 20s, 30s, 40s that he would play. And I heard those songs a lot.
Wow. It's kind of all across the board.
Yeah. And we started taking lessons when we were really little. That was just part of our culture, was to take piano lessons. Mm-hmm. I feel like by the time we were 6, 7, 8 years old, we were taking 2 piano lessons a week, because mm-hmm. you took piano and then you took theory in a group.
Oh, so you were serious even as a kid.
That was just what we did.
Yeah.
And that was just what we did.
I came from a family like that too. Like, it was Suzuki from early on, like treat it as like a discipline and a study. So I definitely relate to that.
That sounds even more serious though to me. This was more like dance class and piano lessons. And this teacher that we took from just happened to do, you know, you would do 2 lessons a week and you just wouldn't. I mean, it was interesting.
It's a great foundation, because it sounds like early on you learned to like keep really regular with your practicing and stuff.
It was a plus and a minus, actually. I think the plus of it was that I learned so much about theory and music and discipline. Like you said, sometimes you had to work through those times when you're like, I don't feel like it. I don't want to practice. But once you were actually practicing or doing the things, you didn't feel like it, you actually got to the other side and that work paid off. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I keep with me all the time, whether it's with, you know, working out. I enjoy getting on a treadmill or going for a walk. Right. Sometimes the first 5 or 10 minutes, maybe you don't feel like it. But once you're doing it, you're usually okay. And at least if you get to the end of whatever it is, you feel like you've accomplished something. On the other hand, I have really used a lot of those. I've learned a lot of what I learned growing up in theory, in music theory. And I've used that through my life in my writing, as well as communicating with others. And then on the other hand, I do feel like it sort of also held me back in a way, thinking I had to learn about something before I could do it.
Interesting.
Whereas with my kids, we're sort of riding that line. Like, on one hand, we want to force them to take lessons, but they, you know, at times they don't want to take lessons. So they're not taking lessons, which is really hard for my husband and I. But I don't know. I guess it was different because I wanted to take the lessons for the most part.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, there is a fine balance between like pushing through difficulty versus like wanting to let someone approach art with their genuine desire and curiosity. Yeah. It's a balance.
And we have every instrument in the house. Just, and, you know, we have them on guitar. We have them hanging on the walls. Mm-hmm. We have drums in the dining room. So we had a piano growing up, but like to touch a guitar was like a big deal, yeah. You know, or a ukulele. We have instruments in every room here.
That's a blessing.
Yeah, no, it totally is. But I don't know if my kids are necessarily, they sort of take it for granted.
Oh my gosh, I can't imagine. Granted. Well,
I'm sorry.
I guess that's like that's the whole thing about when you make your own way as an artist. And then like, I guess the last thing your kids want to do is like follow in mom and dad's footsteps. It's like tale as old as time. I want to pivot and talk a little bit about your cultural heritage. So I don't know if you consider yourself a Jewish singer-songwriter, but like what I know of that tradition is that there's like a long and storied tradition in Judaism of like passing stories and traditions and memories down to the next generation through song and through art. So do you feel like your Jewish heritage informed how you see your job as an artist and a storyteller?
I don't think it has really in any specific way. I mean, I guess culturally, often Jewish people are known for, and also just, it was their practice starting generations ago, mm-hmm. you know, taking things apart, asking lots of questions. Like, that's really central to the Jewish, culture, mm-hmm. is, you know, people did it with the Torah, but, it wasn't necessarily an immediate thing. I think it's just a long generation. There is also literally a generation, a lot of singer-songwriters who are Jewish, you know, yes. Carole King and, I mean, the list goes on and on, lots of Jewish singer-songwriters. So I don't really know. I mean, we definitely value music in our family. That being said, you know, there definitely for my parents was a lot of pushback. Like, well, you want to be an entertainer? You want to be a songwriter?
Yeah.
You know, why do you want to do that? We sent you to college. So I don't think it's a direct, I don't I can analyze it mm-hmm. and come up with, yes, there's definitely a connection in that, but I don't necessarily feel that. I don't think of myself as a Jewish singer-songwriter, mm-hmm. although I am Jewish and I am a singer-songwriter.
No, sometimes that's an important distinction. Like, do I feel like this cultural identity is like front of mind in my art, or no? Is it something that just like affects you more indirectly?
And when I do it, like I wrote a Hanukkah mm-hmm. song with my friend Cliff Goldmacher. I really wanted to write a Hanukkah song because I had started learning more about the holidays as a grown-up. I knew about them growing up, some of the main holidays, but I was really interested in the essence of the holidays and what, you know, what is the, not even like religious, just humanistic, like what can we take and what's special about these holidays that mark our lives? Mm. Like, in Hanukkah, what is there? There is a whole like history or myth about a war and all these different things. But there's also a central, theme of hope. Mm. But so when I wrote the Hanukkah song, one of the things that we brought in, my rabbi along the way told us that there's a tradition for Jewish people that I had no idea until I was like in my 40s, probably, of little melodies that didn't even have words and that you could just sing these little melodies to yourself and kind of meditate on the words, maybe in a prayer or in the Torah or in your head with this little melody that you came up with. And so that's why in this song, the song I have called Light, it's like there's some melodies with no word. There's some melodies with no lyrics. They're just la la la's. And in my head it was, but so it was, I was paying homage to this idea of singing a song that part of it had a feeling, but no lyrics per se. It just had a melody.
I love that. Now, speaking of, you mentioned college just a few minutes ago, and in researching this interview, I learned that you and I have something very nerdy in common, which is a comparative literature degree. And as a singer-songwriter...
Wait, why did you choose yours? Why did you choose comp lit?
Okay, so I don't know if you can relate to this.
And did you have another language too?
Yeah, Spanish and Portuguese. I did a little bit of both, but
okay,
it was more about like genre studies and poetry, my focus. But I was a singer-songwriter, and then I was like, okay, what am I going to do to get like a real degree and a real job? And nowadays I often get this question of like, oh, how does comparative literature, like how would that help your career now? I feel like it applies to being an artist really deeply and directly, but I'm curious how you reflect on that and like how your literature studies influenced your sense of yourself as an artist.
Well, I think I chose comp lit and Spanish. And I was going to add in French. And I was going to add in French, and I kind of learned French, but I didn't fully follow through on that part of it because I was too busy being a musician and an actor.
Relatable.
In college. But, but anyway, I think I chose it for two reasons. One, which is not a very deep reason, but I was so interested in music and theater, and yet it didn't feel like I didn't think my parents would be happy, or in my heart, like I was like, well, it's not, you can't major in music or theater. Those are extra things. Those aren't core things. But comp lit sounded like a really straightforward major. Mm-hmm. And I went to Brown University. So unfortunately with the major, you didn't end up, it was called a concentration. You don't end up taking a bunch of core classes. Like you really take what you want.
Yes.
So I didn't have to take science. I didn't have to take, there was nothing I had to take. So I didn't end up getting that breadth of experience that I wish I had if I had gone back again. And also comp lit, the reason I chose it was because I loved, when I was in school growing up, I loved Spanish, and we would go so deep. We had the best Spanish teachers at my school in Dallas, and we would go so deep into poetry, into culture, into language, into short stories and stories and art. And that really drew me in. And yet when I got to college, it was very dry. It wasn't what I had expected. We were sometimes in grad levels, Spanish classes where we were looking at medieval texts that I didn't even understand
that
I could barely keep my eyes open. And then it's like, we're discussing, does the horse have three legs or do they have four legs? And I'm like, this is not studying Pablo Neruda, or, you know, I had already gone really deep in it already in high school, and in college, I wasn't really going deep anymore in Spanish lit. And also I think that happened a lot in English literature, it was so meta. We weren't, I had loved when I was growing up taking apart poems and taking apart, you know, both in Spanish and English, mm-hmm. like we would go deep, and I loved really thinking through all the language and how it sounded and why they chose these things and point of view and perspective. And I learned a little bit about taking a step back and wondering why they were ready from that perspective. But there's only so much you can do with that. And I was really busy playing music. So I kind of regret doing that because I don't think I learned enough. I think I spent a lot of time procrastinating my major in college and really focusing on music, and the stuff that I had learned that I thought I would learn in Complet, I had already learned in high school mostly. Yeah. And I was kind of burnt out, and it was already part of my life. We had started learning that way ever since I was a little kid, you know, using our senses and right. taking things apart, and just, I don't know. If I went back, I probably would study something different.
What do you think you'd study? Like if you had to enroll today, we're in September.
I'd probably study psych.
Cool.
I'd probably do psych because I went back to grad school for a year. At NYU, it wasn't like you had to get in. You pay and you go, I think. Anyway, I went there for a year and I loved it. It was like, we got to study the brain. We got to study neurology. We got to study, physiology, you know, like your brain.
Yeah.
And I was so curious about how the brain works, and I wanted to be a researcher. And then I realized if I'm going to go to grad school, I need to do it really all in, not sort of do it on the side while I'm a musician. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try being a musician. And then if that doesn't work, then maybe I'll go back to school. But I didn't go back to school.
Life is long. You never know. I believe in your curiosity, no matter what.
Yeah, I do too. I think grown-ups should always learn and kids should always work.
So in your early days as a singer-songwriter, I mean, I'm kind of skipping over some things just because you are an interdisciplinary artist, actor, voice actor. You've had your hand in so many different things. But kind of getting to like how you got on this path as a singer-songwriter, you started out in clubs, coffee houses in the 80s and 90s. What are your memories of that early artistic community that you were a part of? And do you feel like it would be really different to start again as a songwriter today? Like, do you feel like there are big differences between the club and coffee house scene that you got started in and how artists are trying to make their way in today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's twofold. I definitely loved, and I still do love, whenever I open for an artist, whether it's at an amphitheater or a theater, mm-hmm. if I'm the opener, it feels like the early days, like you're trying to, you know, there's definitely a lot of fans in the audience, but at the same time, I'm somebody that they're probably not as familiar with. And so you get that feeling where you try to pick your best songs that mm-hmm. might represent you and like share what you do. And you feel the audience kind of turning to your side, you know, when you have that feeling when you're playing music and you feel like the connection is being made, even if it's in a really large space. So that's what it felt like when I was playing, you know, whether it was in high school when I played in assembly, or in college, my friend Liz and I had a band called Liz and Lisa, Elizabeth Mitchell, and she's a children's artist and also has a band called Ida. But we were so lucky because starting our first show right out of the gate, our whole freshman hall came to see us play. And from then on, we always had great packed crowds and this enthusiasm and people really listening and engaging. So having that, being able to do that, you know, here and there were some shows where there weren't as many people or there was an open mic or whatever. But for the most part, there was always like it felt like the audience was building and they wanted to hear a couple of the songs from the last show and hear some new songs. And it was just this excitement.
There's
no feeling like that. And you feel creative. And also I didn't have kids at the time and my life had a little more space in it. So I would get a song stuck in my head and stay up late and write a song. Now I have to plan things a little bit more. I think the biggest difference is just that there's social media now, which for young singer-songwriters, I mean, that's amazing. You can connect with people, get an audience, mm-hmm. get your music out there. You can record your music on your phone. You can record, you know, we used to have to go record in a studio or on our little four tracks or at the school recording studio. And I feel like people feel more like they're empowered to do everything. I think back in the day, you felt like you needed to be a recording engineer to record things. I still feel that way a little bit, mm-hmm. but I think it's good not to have that fear. That being said, I do think having a live audience is different than having an internet audience.
100%.
I play live stream shows and it's, I don't know if I feel the presence of the audience because of all the comments or because I do already know what it feels like to play in front of actual people. But I would say that's the biggest difference. And also you don't have to be tied to this concept of, oh, when I get a record deal, then I can yes. put a record out. Or, oh, I have to make a full length record. You could put out a song. You could put out an idea.
Mm-hmm. The advent of like the streaming only EP with no physical copy is like, I think a really great thing, especially like when you're just getting started.
There's so many people can use that resource without, and then that being said, sometimes when you just have streaming, there was something special to having, everybody says it's having an album and holding it in your hand or a CD or a cassette tape, looking at the liner notes and all that. But I bet people are.
Did I read that you used to just, you had like your first project was like a purple cassette tape that you would sell?
That was my first solo one. But my friend Liz and I, we had cassette tapes mm-hmm. that we made in college and people still collect them. We had two CDs, one called Days Were Different and one called Liz and Lisa. We're talking about maybe re-releasing them digitally coming up soon.
Oh my gosh. Huge news if true. Thank you for giving us true, the scoop.
We're working on that. But so we had some very successful cassette tapes then. And then when Liz and I went our own separate ways musically, I did make a thing called the Purple Tape, which was for me to get used to being the lead singer of my own songs because Liz was really the lead singer. Even though I wrote a majority of the songs, I wanted to continue singing a lot of those songs and I had to get used to singing them. And also I wanted to have something to sell at shows. We sold cassette tapes at shows and something to present to music business people saying like, this is an acoustic version of the songs. I still thought of myself that I was mostly going to be with my band. But I wanted to record the songs in the simplest way possible.
Okay. So getting to that music business side of things, I mean, you are like one of the GOAT, greatest of all time influencers in terms of like bypassing the gatekeepers on your way to like your artistic journey. I'm sure a ton of our listeners know you had a breakout hit with Stay. I've just read the first time an artist had a Billboard number one single without having a record deal. So how did this change the trajectory of your career? I think we can all imagine some of the like opportunities that might have come up, but I'm curious also how that experience like taught you what it meant to connect with a wider audience and like what it taught you about the types of songs that people really latch onto and connect with.
These are all really great and huge questions. I first want to set the record straight. Although it sounds really, it sounds really magical to have this song that went to number one without a record label. I still was within the system, honestly. Like it's not like today where you could put a song out and distribute it yourself and really literally go to the top of the charts. I think,
like Lil Nas X kind of like drop something on SoundCloud just fully independently.
Exactly. I did not do that. I just had great attorney at the time who I had been working with since I was an independent singer-songwriter. And he just had the wits about him and the knowledge to know that, hey, instead of signing to RCA Records, who's putting out the soundtrack that they want you on, don't sign. Let's license the song to them so that we still have some, not that RCA necessarily wanted to sign me even, but like we wanted to still have freedom to make a choice of what the best record deal was. Just because RCA Records was giving me this amazing opportunity to be on a soundtrack with all these other artists like Crowded House and U2 and Julian Hatfield, and in a major motion picture, we didn't have to sign with them. And so keeping that song independent was a smart business move, but the song went to number one.
Can I just pause and like just unpack that a little bit for our listeners about like, this is like a concept and a principle that like I've held to in my career. And I think I wish a lot more women artists knew about that. Like it is so important to, if you have the choice retain ownership to your own intellectual property as long as you can, because that's like your legacy as an artist. And often it can be like a big financial and creative bargaining chip when you're trying to make deals later on. So I just like want to put a finer point on that, because it's such an interesting way that your career was able to like really stay in your own control, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And also, it's funny, I was talking to another singer-songwriter about this the other day at coffee, that, you know, they were offered a certain amount of money to put one of their songs into a TV show in perpetuity, you know, forever. And it was like a five-figure number.
Right.
And it was, you know, it's not bad, but they're a well-known artist. And they said, you know, talk to my representation, you know, good cop, bad cop. Mm-hmm. And they got the number up to a six-figure. Because they asked, but like, it's a little weird, and I'm still figuring that out for myself, and realized even just the other day, like, I need to be in touch with other musicians. You know, it feels embarrassing to talk about money. It feels embarrassing to talk about deals. It feels, you know, one person can say, oh, I had the best year. I had so many placements. You're like, oh my gosh, I want to work with whoever they're working with. And then you find out, I made $1,000 this year. You're like, for you, $1,000 might not be anything. So it's like everything's relative, but to find out, to be able to take the temperature of what other people are getting, what other things are happening, to be able to find those music business advisors, whether it's literally your advisor or just other friends who are having different experiences, trying to take the temperature of what you can actually do and get away with. Because I agree with you, having control over your own music, your own creativity, your own business, owning masters of your own recordings, all that stuff, it does stay with you. But so with the song Stay, the song was on the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. A radio station in Houston started playing it on their own. That is a very indie thing. Yes. Granted, it was on a major label soundtrack that was full of songs they wanted to hear. They took a chance and played the song. It's funny, the folks who took a chance on the song are still major people in the music business. Mm-hmm. Cubby Bryant is a huge DJ in New York City. Tom Pullman is the head of iHeartRadio. So these are people, they made that choice to play the song, and the story caught on that it was like indie artist, you know. But at the same time, we had an amazing radio department at RCA Records.
Yes.
I wasn't out there like I had been with my own indie records, calling indie radio stations or trying to get some indie press or that kind of thing. There was like a major machine. Once the song was playing, it definitely had its own connection with audiences, but there was still a machine and a group of people who really cared about trying to make it real. I was really lucky because the head of the pop radio department, promotion department, was a really great person who I'm still really good friends with. I just had, hot chicken with him in Nashville a few weeks ago, but like, it was an exciting time, and we were all working, and definitely a lot of grassroots, but also major label, even though it was unsigned artist. So I just wanted to set that record straight.
Okay. I applaud you and I appreciate you, because I really think transparency around like how the sausage gets made in music is like the key to any of us getting fair deals. Like, it feels so individualized these days, and many of us are in our own little silos, and we don't want to admit that we like need some advice or need help navigating these really complicated negotiations in our
creatively
career.
Too. Like, I've been in creative situations where I spent hours and hours and hours and days singing overnight, trying to get the perfect take. And then I found out some of my favorite artists had comped together their vocal tracks.
Mm.
And I had no idea, because you can go out and sing a song and it sounds perfect when you sing live. But sometimes when you go into the studio, you get a little crazy about it. And yes, there are definitely songs I've sung with barely any edits. And there are other songs that have been comped together a little bit from real performances, but who knew?
Do you have a memory of a song that like...
Hey, it's Cindy and Lizzie. This is it. We are down to the wire. The last day to give is December 31st, and we are just 3 donors away from reaching our goal.
Huge thanks to listeners like Neil from Connecticut and Fip from Nebraska. Cool name. You've brought us so close. Now we need your help to just put us over the finish line. Let's do this, guys.
Supporting Basic Folk means supporting honest conversations with folk musicians, sharing their stories, struggles, and inspirations. There's no other space like this. We can't keep going without you.
There is no place like Basic Folk, my beloved Glenda. And this is, and here comes our listeners' chance to give something back to us. When you become a monthly donor, you'll be one of the first to rock our exclusive Basic Folk beanie, which is a fashion iconic statement. And not only that, but these beanies are going to be sporting our fresh new logo, which is dropping in January. The adorable beanies are handmade by Cindy's mom. How sweet is that?
Listen, so sweet. We are asking you, like, what colors you want on your beanie, and then I send them to her, and she's actually, like, pretty incredible at mixing colors together.
Of course she is. She's an artist.
She is an artist. Yeah. And these new tags, the new beanie tags, oh my gosh, it's going to be so great. Time is running out. Go to basicfolk.com/donate to make your gift now. Just $5 a month helps keep Basic Folk alive and thriving.
Bestie, I'm going to hold your hand while I say this. Don't wait. Do not wait. This is your last chance to make a difference this year in the little mighty world of Basic Folk. Please head to basicfolk.com/donate or click the link in the show notes. Either way, it'll get you to the right place. Thanks for the music, and thanks for supporting the stories that we love sharing.
Bye.
Bye. Was like on the far end of the spectrum of like, you kind of just got it in a couple of takes. What's like the most effortless song you've recorded as a vocalist?
I feel like the ones that I record when I'm playing guitar and singing in my mind, and now my co-producer at the time might have different memories of this, but there's a song called How that I did. There's a song, I believe truthfully I did this way. There's a song Every Day, which I did, which I loved recording with the band. And I on that one, I started playing electric guitar while singing, so you didn't hear the guitar as much through the vocal mic, but I was still playing and singing. Those are some of the ones that just maybe also, I think the song Sandalwood, which is also, it's a little slow, but it was real and it was, it just has a, I don't know, there's some kind of energy in it that, that works well because of that.
And sometimes you, like you kind of have to like go off the click and follow your gut when you're doing like live takes.
And there's something, and I was just talking to another artist I was interviewing about this, singing and playing at the same time. God, who was it? Oh, Colin Hay from Minute Work. He's a great singer-songwriter. And he also has found that singing and playing, you sing differently. And sometimes it's easier. I don't know. And then sometimes you go back and overdub your guitar. That's the hard part is when you're like, what I like EQ wise in my vocal mic is very different from what I want in my guitar.
Yes.
And they bleed into each other and then it becomes an issue. But, you know, always trying to figure that out. But you'd ask me also if having the song Stay be a hit song, how that changed things for me and like connecting with audience. I was lucky that I had so much experience performing live and being a band for so long. My friend Liz and I, like I said, we had had so many performances and recordings and live performances that I felt prepared, at least on the singing and playing side. It was a little different when I would get on TV or making music videos. I had done a little bit of that. And as an actor, I felt comfortable kind of in front of people and as a singer-songwriter, but I didn't know like you're supposed to wear in-ear monitors on live TV or that you could go back in and have them edit things slightly if there was something off.
Hot tip.
I have no idea.
Hot tip.
I don't know if they still do that, but I didn't know that. So there's certain things that I would have fixed or done slightly differently had I understood. Or even working with stylists and hair and makeup people who say, no, this looks great. And you're like, okay. And then you realize I actually wanted something a little different. And I was excited to collaborate and rely on these other folks. So along the way, you know, you learn lessons about all that and what's important to you, what's not. You know, even you think of someone like Bob Dylan, he's so real, you know, but then you're like, wait, he changed his name.
Yeah, he's a performer like anyone, you know, too.
He's an entertainer and a performer. You look at he makes choices about himself and his presentation. So,
okay, I have kind of one more question about your greater artistry before we dig into the new record. Can you talk a little bit about your voice acting and like where that journey started for you and whether like your memories and experiences as a voice actor impact how you record as a musician?
I think they both feed on each other. Mm-hmm. The first voiceover I did, I had been acting since I was a little kid. It was just something I always loved and did and studied, and musical theater. And I along the way, I think Hallmark asked mm-hmm. if I would sing the song for a commercial. And that was also back, I think that was still back in the day when there was a little bit of a push and pull, like as a real musician, do I really want to be in a commercial? You know,
right.
Am I selling out?
In this economy, I feel like that conversation is so long gone.
It's so long gone. And also, you know, the quality of, there's really great songs and commercials and.
Yes.
So with Hallmark, I mean, it was a product I definitely used. I liked Hallmark. And so I said I would do the song, but only if I could do the voiceover too. Mm. And so I did the voiceover and it was just a really good match. It was something I really enjoyed doing. It was very natural for me. I loved working with the producers and the directors and the writers on the commercials. And so I continued doing it. I got an agent and I audition all the time and I get one out of every kajillion auditions I do, but I've had some really great voiceover. I've had some really great commercials I've gotten to do. And I guess the biggest thing is that it reminds me that you can really tell a story with your voice in different ways mm. and you need to listen to what you're doing. That being said, sometimes I have to watch out being too musical theater-y or too expressive, too consciously expressive and emotive with my voice because it comes off sounding fake, which is also something that can happen with a lot of vocal training for me. Like I have to watch, I like having vocal training. I've had some great teachers and just making sure that the technique doesn't get in the way of just my regular style, but also that my style doesn't get in the way of like proper singing that I can mm-hmm. do for many, many years. So that's an interesting.
Ooh, it's a fine balance. It sounds like
balance. Yeah.
So when did you realize that you had a gift for creating music for children?
It was when I started doing it, really. I mean, when I was a kid, there was some music that I loved from when I was a kid. And I always wanted to make music like Really Rosie, Free to Be You and Me and Really Rosie were two albums I loved.
Free to Be You and Me, my mom and I love that. Oh, that's great.
It's so good. I know. And it was so good. And it was sort of grown-up-y mm-hmm. or babysitter-y sounding. Like it was sounded grown-up-y. But, and I also loved music in summer camp and singing popular songs with a group of kids in a cabin with a guitar. It was so connecting mm-hmm. and warm. And also we would change all the lyrics, which was hilarious. So that was sort of in the back of my head and part of my experience as a musician growing up. And I think, again, it was a business opportunity. Barnes and Noble, the bookstore, said, hey, do you want to do a record that's different from your regular records? And this was at a time that CD sales were sort of slowing down. Mm-hmm. People were buying records less and less in record stores. Streaming, I think, was starting to happen. And they, one of the options, they said, you know, you could make a kid's record. And I thought, you know what? I kind of want to do that. I almost didn't want to do it because my friend Liz had been so successful doing it. And I was like, well, that's her. I grew up with brothers and sisters. And it's like,
oh, that's your
her
thing.
I shouldn't do it because she does it. And then I realized, well, I kind of really do want to do it. And it would be really cool to have a record at Barnes and Noble mm-hmm. because I buy lots of things there. And I bet other people who have kids would buy things there. And I didn't have kids. It was less about wanting to make music for kids than wanting to make music for my nostalgia of being a kid.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to reach out to Liz and see if she'll help me make this record. So it won't be like I'm stepping on any toes. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, she can really show me, you know, I can get to work in her world and how she does things because her records were beautiful. And so we made my first kid's record together called Catch the Moon. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it. And there was something different and freeing about doing some cover songs, some original songs, and just taking a break from even the slight concept that like, oh, maybe I'll have a hit song because having a hit song is this great way to connect with people. That being said, when you start consciously trying to write a hit song, often those are the worst songs. So it's just, that's a weird Zen thing. And it was fun to be able to put that aside and just have a different focus and have a different puzzle to to put together, which was a kids record. And from there, I went to make my Camp Lisa record still before I had kids. And I made all these summer camp songs, and that was really fun. And I really had started digging into collaborating, which was also a really fun way to make music. And it felt less scary and less heavy. And I went on from there, just continuing to make family friendly kids music.
I love that idea that there are still corners of the music industry that are kind of like free from the shadow of like pressure and success. I mean, not that there's no pressure there, but the creation is like, it's supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to be a hit, quote unquote. I love that.
Right. And I mean, it's a luxury to have had a couple of hits. It's like amazing. You definitely can connect with way more people and have way more opportunities. But it is fun to talk to established singer-songwriters, and really behind all of that is just wanting to make things and that magic of going in a room, whether it's by yourself, with other people, sitting in your car, being inspired by other people's music, writing something, making something. And so it's just like this amazing journey to be able to do that.
That journey is like on full display in a very fun way on That's What It's All About, which is your new, I want to call it a children's album, but it's also a lot more than that because it feels like an intergenerational conversation, or like it feels like a moment where a family sits together on the floor singing together, you know, intergenerational.
Yes.
And Take It While the Taking's Good is one of the originals on the album that really touched me. It's like a song for and about elders, but also for and about children. So did writing with your elders in mind make you think about the type of elder you want to be and the kind of voice that you'd want to have as like an older person years down the line?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to think about it. I think when you're writing family-friendly music, or really what we were trying to do was emulate the songs that I grew up with and that Tracy and Greg from the Hollow Trees also grew up with. Songs like Mersey Dotes and Dozy Dotes and Little Lambsy Divey. It's very playful and clever. It's playful and clever. Don't Fence Me In. Again, playful, clever, and has a little bit of a message about not wanting to be tied down to anything in particular or anyone. Songs like The Hokey Pokey, which are just fun and uplifting lyrics. Songs like The Doodlin' Song, which again is whimsical and funny. It has funny sounding words, but all of these songs were grown up songs. They weren't kids songs. And so we wanted to make something like that. And so we wrote Take It While the Taking's Good because I think it both grew from images. I think we were trying to figure out, well, what do we want to write about? Like what that often happens with writing family friendly music is there a message, which, you know, could be very, like, overpowering and annoying, or it could be just a great seed of an idea. Yeah. And so we came up with the idea that we wanted to say, literally, take it while the taking's good. Do things before, you know, one of my favorite lyrics is, don't miss the buffet before they take it away.
Yeah.
And so playing with these like silly, and you know, images that are whimsical, like eat the ice cream before it falls off the, you know, eat the ice cream bar before it falls off the stick. Just a way of saying, you know, take advantage of life and using all these like whimsical images that could be, that are timeless. That was the thing. We wanted to write things that were timeless. And then Greg also wrote a song called Keep Growing for Tracy,
so
who had gotten through cancer. And, it's just a great song and it's old timey. And then these songs end up making their way into our grown up music. I know it does for me, thinking about like, what message do I want to, do I have a message? Is there something I want to say? Because often I don't think of things necessarily as like broken hearts. And I'm at a different place now than I was when I first started writing when I was a kid, and definitely when I was in college and after college. So continuing to try to like center myself and think like what's important to me. And sometimes it isn't a message. Sometimes it isn't like a tale to tell, or there has to be some kind of a lesson that you learn. But those are fun ways to collaborate. So that's how Taken While the Taken's Good came around. And we wanted it to sound old timey.
It's so fun. The whole album is so fun. It occurred to me while I was listening to this album that the title track is a really big swing. Like, I know, like, whether it be karaoke or a cover at a big show, whatever, it's so intimidating to cover a well-known song that everybody knows the lyrics to, because it's like you have so many people's expectations to live up to. So how did you, Lisa Loeb, approach your interpretation of the Hokey Pokey?
The Hokey Pokey. We actually all agreed that the song was so important to us. And I'm a child of the 70s. For us, it was a big thing, like at roller skating parties. You would run out there during the roller skating party. And I like the old timey version, where it sounds like groups of people singing songs. And I also, Tracy and I especially talked about how being a live performer for family friendly shows, you also want it to sound in a way that really makes people want to participate and be a part of it. So not corny, but definitely a little silly, real instruments. I'm a big fan of sort of playing it the way it goes, yes. not making it like the reggae version of the Hokey Pokey. Like, I didn't want to do that. I wanted it to be somebody looks for the Hokey Pokey, they find our version, and it reminds them of the other older versions that they used to listen to. And that goes to all music that I make, all music that I know Tracy and Greg make from the Hollow Trees, and all music that my peers in the children's music world make. We don't want to sound fake. We want to sound like we're just us singing with you. Maybe it's a little more professional because we want it to sound like we went to a recording studio and we recorded, but it sounds real. You know, it's got to be real. And also have the right amount of energy so that if somebody put it on at the sock hop, at the party, at the roller skating party, somebody would want to get up and sing the song. We even had a little conversation in the middle of it, Tracy and I. She's got a background in improv as well and acting. And so we had a little back and forth, like, come on, well, what do you think of this? Well, I don't know. What do you, you know, a little back and forth, which was fun.
The chemistry is so great on the song and on the record. It feels like having great chemistry with the other performers is actually so, so important, like especially important when you're making family-friendly music. Can you talk about your friendship with the Hollow Trees and how that led to the arrangements that we're hearing on the album?
Yeah, I went to go see them. I went to a children's music or a children's event. It was like a little event in a park, and there were some bands playing, and theirs was one of the bands playing. And this is when I did finally have a child. I had a baby. And I saw them, and they were just so good. It was exactly what we're talking about. I could imagine them being at a grown-up concert or a kid's concert, but they were so funny and kitschy. And like, I'm a big fan of Paul Rubens, Pee Wee Herman, and John Waters, and just fun with vintage things and people and music. And their original songs were so funny and clever. And I thought, I really want to make something with them. But they were authentic, you know, real upright bass player and accordion player and bouzouki player who plays mandolin and guitar playing. And then once I got to know them, I asked if they would make this record with me because I had been wanting to make a record of the songs I listened to growing up. And they liked that idea, and they were a fan of mine as well. And they've become friends, really. You know, we have a lot in common. I actually have gone roller skating with Tracy.
That's so cute.
You know, we have similar memories and nostalgia of similar time periods. And she used to have a vintage store. So when we make videos, we go through her clothes and figure out which clothes we're going to wear and how the videos are going to be made. And they're also very deep into the graphic art of all their art and the video making and every part of what we do. So when we record, you know, Tracy puts out all these great snacks, and the people that are in their band are just really good people who know how to play really well. And so it's like you can get that sound that I think a lot of us aspire to. You know, you listen to the Beatles and people who used to play a lot live together. And when they recorded, it's not perfect, but you really connect with it because it's real and it's human.
And you can hear the connection in the recordings. It feels like that's what matters.
That's what it's all about.
That's what it's all about. Okay, so movement has come up so much in this conversation, and it seems like it's a very important part of your artistic practice. So your quote on A Doodle in Song was, that we realized it needed a solo, but not just any kind of solo, a tap solo. So Talk to us about your tap dancing practice. How the hell do you record tap dancing for an album? And like, are there specific inspirations or other dancers that you look to in a moment like this where you are recording yourself tap dancing for a record?
Well, tap dancing was something I did. I think I took lessons for about a year mm-hmm. in eighth grade or seventh grade. Cause I was also, I took jazz and musical theater mm-hmm. and ballet for years and years. And I did tap a little bit and I really loved it, but I was so busy doing other things. I guess I just didn't follow through on it. But then as a grown up, I took one tap lesson maybe 20 years ago and I slipped and fell on my butt. And
no.
I was like, I was so embarrassed. I was like, I'm not taking tap lessons. But then before COVID, I was taking a little bit of dance class. A friend of mine actually from high school who happened to live here in Los Angeles, even though I'm from Texas, she was teaching dance classes at the community theater, at the community center nearby. So I started taking dance with her and I loved it so much. It can be intimidating, I know, in LA and New York when you're in a beginner's class and you're with people who could be professionals in a music video, a hip hop music video. And that's not me. I'm an intermediate beginner dancer. I'm not good at hip hop. So I started doing dance, and in one of the classes that was a hip hop class, which I wasn't good at, I noticed there were tap dancers coming in and out of the class mm-hmm. right before our class. And I was like, what are you guys doing? They're like, oh, well, we're a tap. And it was all like moms or grownups. Mm-hmm. And so I started joining their tap class, and then COVID hit. And during COVID, I ended up getting private tap dance classes from that teacher.
That's so
outside
great.
My house once a week. With another friend, and we would do tap dance. And so I really got back into it. And I generally separate my dancing from my music. I'm not somebody who's dancing up on stage. I'm literally standing in one place plugged
right.
in. But I still was taking dance classes. So I just thought this would be a fun kind of challenge. I'm definitely not like some of the, I have a friend, Larry Goldings, who just made a full record with this unbelievable tap dancer. I am not in that area. This was like much more basic, but my friend Jeannie, who's one of my teachers, dance teachers and friends, helped me choreograph, some dance for the tap dance solo. And it was a big challenge and it was really fun. And I was like, I don't care if I look like I'm some kid who's taking tap dance and I'm doing a tap solo, but we did it. And you just set up a mic. We had a good floor, set up some mics, sounded good and went for it.
That's so cool.
If you watch the video, though, you don't see me doing the exact steps as the solo because we were dancing on a green screen and the floor was kind of sticky because it was painted. It wasn't sticky, but chalky. And I was wearing not tap shoes that were sort of sticking to the floor. So we did some similar moves, but we didn't do the whole thing.
Okay, yes. For our technically inclined tap dancing influenced listeners,
yes.
You need to watch the video with this context in mind. And not write in any emails that the tap steps don't match up. I love that.
Yeah.
It feels like you have successfully kept playfulness as like a central part of your life into adulthood. Do you feel like there are times when it's like, oh, this playfulness that I've kept in my life is unusual for an adult? Do you feel like it makes you different from other people, you know, in your age group? And does that playfulness like kind of make you stand apart?
Every once in a while I realize that, but I live in a bubble of similar sort of ageless friends mm. who have so many different interests, and I just always want to explore or be nostalgic, who appreciate, you know, just a good fuzzy pillow or what, I don't know, like all. I live in a world of this, and this is
yeah.
typical for me. Every once in a while, when I'm in a more sort of conservative place, I realize that it's not so typical, but it does, it just that. And then I appreciate living in Los Angeles or having lived in New York or having gone to college where I found my people, mm-hmm. where this wasn't unusual, where this just felt normal.
Yeah. I mean, that creative community where people are down to like try something brand new, do something a little silly. I feel like that's what gives us longevity as humans.
Yeah,
like,
it feels normal.
Yeah.
I don't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, every once in a while somebody's like, what? You're making, I don't know, chocolate, or you're mm-hmm. making peanut butter M&M cookies at 11 and you're make, I don't know. It's like, well, yeah, it just seemed like my son really wanted to do mm-hmm. that, or make some crazy ramen, something, something. I'm like, no, we can't do that. The instructions are in Japanese. And my son's like, well, just use this app. And before you know it, we've got like a full Japanese restaurant in our kitchen. Like,
okay, tech
it just
wizard.
Seems normal. No. It just seems normal. Yeah. Like it's that's just like ever since I was a kid. I said this recently in another interview, so I'm sorry if it overlaps.
That's so fine.
It reminded me that in my high school yearbook, you know, you put quotes and little things, and mine was most. It was a from a book called Peace Breaks Out, and the quote that. This is not the exact quote, but it's something like, most of all, he did not want to be like most people were. That is, eaten by the termites of a half-life semi-lived. Like, I want to live life to its fullest, whatever that means.
Take it while the taking's good. I was going to say get while the getting's good, and then I was like, that's not correct. Yeah. It's take.
Take it while the taking's good. It's true. It's like...
Take is way better than get, actually.
Yeah.
You have to actively grab the whimsy into your life. I love that.
Yeah, do it. And it does also mean practical things like try to get enough sleep, and if you don't, take some naps, or like be organized and make sure you eat well and learn things and take care of the practical things in your life. But then... create that space for creative freedom and trying to enjoy life.
I have one more question before I invite you to do a lightning round. Okay, so this reading about and listening to this record was my first time coming across the term fake book. Can you explain what a fake book is and where it fits into this album?
Yeah, a fake book is a book with the lead sheet, which is like the melody and the chords. Usually in my mind, it's usually for piano, but they make them I guess for guitar, you just read the chords and you play them on guitar. Sometimes they'll have the actual little chord, you know, the guitar neck, little, what is that doodad called? You know, imprint, and it shows you how to play the chords, but
the tab,
but usually they're just like they're very, very short, quick, melody and lyric and chords. And I think they're these big binders with all this sheet music in it. And I think what happened was it wasn't legal maybe for a while to have them. So people would just like Xerox them or just copy them, or they were mimeographed.
Oh, because they were reproducing popular songs.
I think so, but maybe. And then you see them when you see like a piano player at a bar, they might have a fake book so that if somebody request a song, they can quickly turn to that song and they can just read it off the sheet music. But I should look and see. I think it had something to do with it being, I feel like it was illegal. Now you can buy them legally, but I feel like for a while fake books were not even legal. It was like this underground thing, but from the
olden
days.
Like the bootleg version of like popular songs. I love that.
The fake book. Why fake book? What is that? Why do they call it a fake book? They're lead sheets and... Oh, funny. It says, when presented with a lead sheet, proficient musicians may be able to fake it by performing the songs adequately without a full score. I don't know if that's true. Fake books, I guess they used to do pirated and counterfeit ones, which were illegal, but.
Okay, that's very fun. Yeah, I just had never heard of that. And then in the press materials for the album, it was talking about how like, you know, a couple of the songs were like favorites from fake books growing up. So it just made me so curious about that tradition.
Yeah. That's like my dad would open the book and we would like leaf through the book and there'd be like hundreds of songs. Mm-hmm. And we'd just leaf through and then we'd stop on one of the songs and play, you know, Here Comes Peter Cottontail, and then flip through and play.
That's so fun. It's like a bootleg secular family hymnal.
Yeah, exactly.
Fun new basic folk vocab term. Okay, are you down to do a very quick lightning round? Don't think too hard about the questions.
Okay.
Just shoot from the hip. Okay. Are you a cat person or a dog person?
Cat person.
What was the last movie you saw and loved?
I'm trying to think of the last movie I saw. Well, I started Jaws the other night, but we didn't finish it. And I've seen it before, but I do love it.
Incredible movie, incredible music. Who is your favorite Muppet, if you have one?
Oh, I just thought of like Animal, but then I was going to say Miss Piggy, and then I was like, oh, but Kermit. I don't know. It's really
them as a couple is really also a good answer.
Yeah. I feel like Miss Piggy stands out because she's pink, and I love pink. But
yes,
she's not my favorite. I wouldn't want to hang out with her. You know, I'd rather hang out with like Kermit.
Sick. Yeah, there's different Muppets for different moods, I guess.
Yeah.
Who is the cartoon character you relate the most to? Not necessarily the one you like, but who do you feel a kinship?
Snoopy.
oh, Snoopy. I love when he, well, to me, Snoopy is a girl. Snoopy gives me girl energy. Like when she like closes her eyes and dances like this with her ears dangling, it's the cutest.
Oh my gosh, I never thought of Snoopy as a girl.
I just assume.
I just like that Snoopy's in their own world and they're always busy doing something. I love Snoopy.
I think that's right on. What is your biggest pet peeve?
There's so many pet peeves.
It doesn't have to be the biggest. You can just give me one or two.
One of them that happened today, I was at a school assembly and there was a stage on a higher level, and yet they may have been doing it to be with the audience, but they were standing on ground level speaking to the whole crowd. Whereas if they were just standing two steps up or even on the stage, you could have seen them as well as hearing them. Again, they may have done that on purpose because they wanted to be closer to the kids, but that was a pet peeve.
That one actually very much resonates with me because I feel like as a musician, sometimes I am filled with rage, like when I go to a wedding and like things are not working well with the mics and like people aren't talking into the mic, or like whoever the wedding planner is and hasn't prepped everyone that like you're going to be holding the mic like this. Like,
yes,
please let us hear your beautiful words and vows. Please let us be part
of
this moment.
or you can't hear it, or it's like too bassy. I've been known to go at public events like school or weddings or whatever and like turn things down, turn the high end down a little. I'm like, you're really blasting everybody out here.
I love to hear that you're that type of person. We had a previous guest, a good friend of mine, Brian Dunn. He's always like, at a wedding, just let me play the song. I don't want to have to be worried that it's not going well. Like, I'm happy to play your wedding. Just let me play it.
mics can be an issue. Oh my gosh, I'm so picky and have so many pet peeves. I was just thinking of a pet peeve the other day. I mean, I don't like people leaving their shoes all over the floor at my house.
Those are two very strong pet peeves.
People leaving dishes in the dishwasher leaving dishes in the sink when the dishwasher's right there and it still has space for dishes. There's more pet peeves. I've got so many pet peeves.
What's your astrological sign?
I'm a Pisces.
Interesting. Let our woo-woo listeners interpret as they will. What's your favorite ice cream flavor?
Baskin-Robbins chocolate chip.
So good. What is an instrument that you don't know how to play that you would love to learn?
Banjo.
So fun. What is the best time of day to write a song?
Right after I drink coffee.
And finally, what is the best age to be?
Probably just the age that you are. But I will say also, 8 is good.
Mm. That's a very strong answer. Lisa, you have been such a cool guest. Thank you so much for being generous with your stories. And I hope all of our listeners will go out and get the new album. That's what it's all about. You've just been such a great guest. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can find us on folkalley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app, or you can get us wherever you got this podcast that you're listening to now.
Send this episode to somebody who has successfully kept their inner child alive and thriving. Send this to your playful friend.
Send this to the weirdest person you know.
That is a less nice way of saying what I just said.
Weird. We're into it. Okay, thanks for listening all the way to the end. We love you so much. Talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.